difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with...
Tosh Robinson.
Genevieve Kosky.
And...
Scott Tobias.
This week we're talking about Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, a new fact-based sort of comedy starring Tina Fey, written by Faye's 30 Rock and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt partner Robert Carlock, adapted from a memoir by journalist Kim Barker, and directed by Glenn Ficarra and John Requa, the team behind Focus, Crazy Stupid Love, and other films. The films are strikingly different in many ways. Ficarra and Requa bring a studied approach to the direction that owes little to Altman. MASH is very much a movie driven by guys, while Faye's gender factors into the story in ways both large and small, from the ways her colleagues treat her to the steps she has to take to avoid offending Afghans. I'd also argue that despite its shambolic structure, MASH has a much clearer sense of purpose than Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, but we can get into that in a bit. Yet they're also very much films about makeshift and fluid communities of outsiders that spring up in the middle of war zones. On this half of the podcast, we're going to place one next to the other and see how they approach a similar subject, consider the differences between the approaches, and discuss whether the wars themselves affect the films attempting to portray them.
Miss Baker, this is an extreme environment.
Grenade, down, down!
I've seen people with actual experience make bad decisions here.
You should let me interview you.
But I do not know you. How can we get to know each other?
Yes, Keith, excellent.
It's bananas here. I don't think I can do this.
We are all here for a reason.
So what's your reason?
I just wanted out of my job. I wanted out of my mildly depressive boyfriend.
What are we doing, Kim?
Just wanted to blow everything up.
That's the most American white lady story I've ever heard.
So, MASH, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Two different films, I guess, in many different ways. What did how do you think Whiskey Tango Foxtrot compares to MASH and vice versa? Scott, we'll start with you.
Well, I think MASH has a really strong point of view, and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot has got a whole lot of things it's trying to do, and it's kind of okay at every one of them.
Yeah, it's fine. It's a fine movie, and it's weirdly, but I think kind of to expand on your point, it's like. It's sort of about journalism. It's sort of about being a woman in a war zone. It's sort of about Afghanistan, and it doesn't really commit to anything. And ultimately, it's sort of a romance.
It's sort of about modern media and trying to sell war and like turn it into a profitable package.
It's sort of about female friendships.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say next. It's sort of about this friendship between the and ultimately, it feels like it's sort of about all those things until it's not. And ultimately, I'm not sure what it is about.
Yeah.
It's carried along very nicely by Faye. It's never. Dull, but it's I don't know.
Could I add another sort of since we have it's sort of like Liz Lemon in Afghanistan, but not because it can't be. You can't really have her being completely fumbling through the chaos of that situation. So it's sort of a fish out of water comedy, but not. It can't make her a complete buffoon. So it's not 30 Rock, even though it is written with her longtime partner Robert Carlock.
I wonder if, like, how much, I haven't read the books that either of these movies are based on, so this is a shot in the dark just based on my understanding of them, but I wonder how much that has to do with the fact that Hooker was a war vet who was writing, like, pointed satirical fiction about his experiences and the era, whereas Whiskey Tango Foxtrot came out of a memoir, which is, I've read parts of it, and it's very much a grab bag of this happened and then this happened. Here's a funny story. Here's a sad story. So, like, it's kind of, from what I have read of it, it's more political than the movie is. And a lot of that was shaved off. Some of the rougher, like, more specific edges were shaved off. It was kind of comedied up a little, like, to make it more of a Tina Fey story. But, you know, one of these things is just very much an anecdotal series of life happenings, and the other one is kind of a spear thrust at that this guy's life and everything about it that made him angry.
I'm kind of speaking from a position of ignorance here, but I'm not sure how satirical the original novel was, because I know that Lardner, the screenwriter Ring Lardner, talks about how it was basically just a straight-up comedy. And for all the differences that Altman made to his screenplay, And for all the friction that created, they both kind of agreed that the spirit of both things were the same. One thing I remember from a friend of mine's parents' basement, they had, you know, a wall of paperbacks, and there were all these sequels to MASH, which you may not be, you're not in familiarity, but I have a list of them here. MASH Goes to Morocco. MASH Goes to Montreal. MASH Goes to Las Vegas. And I don't really know how these adventures play out in various
when the Korean War spread to Las Vegas.
Well, wow. I'm kind of fascinated by, I think I'm going to go read MASH Goes to Montreal just to see what Montreal is like.
Do you
like.
Know how much I would enjoy a Keith Phipps big box of paperbacks? That was
I was
just
thinking the same thing.
Keith walking his way through the MASH books. Yeah. Please do that.
My impression.
Montreal is hell.
Anyway, I think
my impression is that Altman disliked the book. I know he referred to the book as racist, but he disliked the book.
Well, thank God he eliminated the racism from the well, story.
Again. Okay. And then,
for a variation on this conversation, see the first half of this podcast.
We're here to bully you relentlessly.
So yeah, I don't know either of these books, so I can't speak to the relationship between them. But yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting comparisons to be made, though, between the two films, particularly this concept of the kabubble. I think it's not quite as confined in MASH. MASH is a little more spread out, but they still are at a remove from the war itself, and a culture develops that would not have developed otherwise.
One of the things that frustrated me about Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is the feeling that you never really get a sense of either what's going on in the bigger picture in Afghanistan or what's going on with the bigger picture in the press corps. And I think that one of the best parts of MASH is that opening sequence where Altman puts the cameras on helicopters and makes such a point of circling this camp and showing you the confines of it, showing you no matter how solid and real a place it may seem when you're actually down there from the air, it is just this little, it's a kabubble. It's a Korean kabubble. You know, it's this tiny little temporary community that people come and go from, and it's only real while you're there. I think that's a brilliant conceit.
Well, let me push back a little bit about that. Let me defend Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, because this is a film that is locked into one point of view. This is a film that follows Tina Fey. And so whatever her experience is and whatever the limits of her experience are, that's what we experience and that's what we know. Altman has the freedom as being more omniscient to show you a much larger picture. But I think it's more of a feature of Whiskey Tango Foxtrot that maybe Tina Fey's perspective on the war is limited as it is. And I think we kind of get a nice impression, and again, to the film's credit, of the diminishing interest in anything coming out of Afghanistan. And she's there for that. She's there for, you know, she's on the ground at first and she gets lots of stories. But then it's like, you know, what story could possibly come out of Afghanistan that would we be interested in running? You know, interest in the war diminishes, and then the culture changes where she's at. And I think that is something that the film captures quite well.
I also think that, you know, when we're talking about differences between the film, is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot has a very specific timeline and a very clear narrative as opposed to the episodic structure of MASH, which gives it more of almost kind of an anthropological feel, like you're just kind of dipping into this world and you don't get a huge sense of the internal life of any of those characters, and you get a huge sense of the internal life of Baker and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. You know, Keith and Scott, you suggested this pairing because neither Tasha nor I had seen MASH, so we kind of, you know, took your word for it that this was you know, a good pairing. And it is a good pairing, almost more for the contrasts than the direct comparisons. But so I think I was going into it not really prepared for that anthropological approach. I was expecting a narrative and I was expecting characters that I could connect to. And when it became clear that's how I was getting it, I wasn't really able to adapt my viewing quickly enough.
I mean, I think that that's an interesting, it says something interesting about the shift in how journalism, both how journalism works and how film storytelling works. I think MASH is much more about what the characters do, and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is much more about what the characters feel. And I think that's just kind of how journalism goes. Another big difference, I think, for all of us is we talked about the difficulty of approaching MASH from the perspective of people when it came out and how people felt about the Vietnam War. Whereas one of the things that most struck home for me about Whiskey Tango Foxtrot was I can relate with to that feeling of, yes, what's going on in Afghanistan is important and these are real people's lives, but I'm also weary of hearing the same stories. And that conference at the end with her boss, where her boss is like, nobody wants to hear it. I'm like, I kind of sympathize. Like, I want to be more engaged with what's going on in her life and what's going on in the real world in Afghanistan than I am. But how many stories can you hear of, you know, insurgents killed this many people without getting like a certain amount of empathy fatigue?
But I wish the film had hit that point harder than it did. I don't think Altman would.
Well, it had a million other points to hit.
It did have a lot of points to hit, but that is such a critical thing in the movie. That's such a critical dynamic in the movie, because she's there for that. She's there for that diminished interest. And we know that the media was so responsible for ginning up excitement over going to war, but then there's just no follow through at all. No follow up from the government, no follow through for the media, no follow through in terms of the public interest in the war. We're all interested in going there and not interested in actually what is going to happen 10 years down the line. And that's a really important point to make that the film makes, but doesn't make it with anywhere near the sharpness.
Yeah, I think you should leave, and I should leave. We should all leave feeling horrible about that, about the empathy fatigue. When in fact it's just like it's kind of like, yeah, something else that happens. You know, we should move on to our topics that we've assembled here. Humor. Let's talk about that. I mean, it is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is a comedy of sorts. MASH is certainly a comedy, a very dark comedy. I wouldn't call WTF a black comedy necessarily, though. The humor is not, there's certainly a fair amount of violence and a horrible situation, yet I'm not sure there's like that morbid streak of humor that MASH has. Tasha, this is your topic, so what do you think?
No, I agree with you. I think that I was expecting, when I came up with the topic, it was before I'd watched MASH, and I was expecting it to hew a little closer to the TV show and a little closer to WTF than it actually did. I think they end up being very different in, they're both approaching the same thing, which is how people use humor in a bad situation to survive. And I think also how people kind of reach for bleak humor in order to, as like a survival mechanism, as an automatic survival mechanism. But they end up being, in their approach, very, very different. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, I think, has a much more one-liner approach that's much more for the audience than for the character. There's not a lot of sense that the characters are using humor to survive, whereas I think that that's what MASH is going for. Roger Ebert's review had a line in it that I thought was really interesting. We laugh at MASH because it's so true to the unadmitted sadist in all of us, and it's the flat-out poker-faced hatred in MASH that makes it work. Most comedies make us want to laugh at things that aren't really funny. In this one, we laugh precisely because they're not funny. And to me, that sums up why the humor in MASH doesn't work for me, because I don't know that I've got the unadmitted sadist. He goes on to talk a lot in that review about how satisfying it is to just hate somebody thoroughly and utterly and see them torn down. And there's so much of that humor in MASH. Nothing like that in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I think if she has any sort of sense of hate in her at all, it's less for the situation or the people around her and more for her own indecisiveness until she kind of finds herself.
Yeah, I think the humor in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is more self-deprecating than anything, and not just on Kim's part, on pretty much everyone in the kabubble kind of puts on an armor of basically kind of acting like the characters in MASH. You know, there's a definite sense that the way in which they relate to each other sort of crassly and crudely and occasionally cruelly is born of a certain amount of trauma. And I think that's something that is maybe implied in MASH, but it's not engaged with as clearly as it is in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
I think, and this kind of segue to a topic I'm bringing to the table, is something that's related to how the different attitude towards the military. I think they're reflective of the times as well, where MASH is very skeptical of the military in general, and there's very little respect. I mean, the people that we spend the most time with are people who are kind of either drafted or not necessarily on board with what they're being asked to do. And Whiskey Tango Foxtrot has a much more, kind of reflects the general attitude right now, which is respect for the military and sort of deference and awe at the courage needed to go into this zone. I mean, you know, I think also the difference there is an audience that might be drafted, an audience that most likely won't as well. I think there's that as well. I mean, with the all-volunteer army, it's you know, these people are doing things I would never do. If I'm watching this, you know, as one of the original audience of MASH, I'm thinking I could get dragged in this situation too. You know, I think that makes a difference as well. I really liked in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot the relationship between Tina Fey's character and Billy Bob Thornton's character. I think that was one of the strongest elements of the film, where she is, you know, inexperienced journalism whose tenacity wins his respect, and he is a consummate professional who kind of likes the fact that she is coming into things from a different angle too. I thought that was quite nicely done, and it is far, far removed from anything you would see in MASH.
I think part of the difference there, as well as the volunteer army versus a group of draftees, is the difference between the protagonists are all technically part of the military hierarchy, even if they don't respect it or participate in it, versus all of the military people seen in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot are really distant side characters. You know, they're subjects for Kim Baker's stories. She's embedded alongside them, but they're really very minor characters. And I think that lets them be freer to be kind of these like exalted, brave, relatively simple, sympathetic characters, because they're just like a side element in the story and not one of the more important ones.
But also to that point, even though the characters in MASH are technically part of the military, they are removed from the action in the same way that the journalists in the Kabul are removed from the action, where they are still faced with it and they are faced with those horrors, but they are not, with the exception of a couple embeds that Kim Baker goes on, they are not directly involved with the war. You know, they are playing their part in the greater ecosystem of it, but they are not soldiers. They are not footmen. And maybe that remove creates a certain sense of helplessness or impotence that affects the use of bleak or black humor. It also means that they are spending a lot of time not fighting a war.
Yes.
So that transitions into your topic, Scott.
Yes, thank you, Genevieve. My topic is downtime. One important reality of war is that it's boring. Not all movies about war acknowledge that, because they too would be boring. But Whiskey Tango Foxtrot and MASH both take place largely in the downtime between incidents of violence and bloodshed. And within that contained environment, which WTF calls the kabubble, a debased culture starts to emerge. There are pranks and parties and heavy drinking. Relationships develop and intensify that might not under normal circumstances. You know, Tina Fey and Margot Robbie are probably not friends outside Kabul. Tina Fey and Martin Freeman are probably not lovers. It seems unlikely, too, that any of them would be inclined to party quite as hard as they do in journalist quarters. It's unnatural for war movies to focus on those long stretches of time when there isn't any major incident. But by doing so, WTF makes those times when Fey is on the move all the more startling. You know, for her to leave journalist quarters and head off to Kandahar, for example, that has a shock to it that's like emerging from, you know, a dark theater into a bright afternoon. I think the power of both of these movies is that they make us forget the war enough to be shocked by those moments when the war asserts itself.
I agree.
Okay. yeah, I mean, so I think it's important to note those periods, but before when you're sort of waiting anxiously for something to happen, you know, and what kind of culture develops in this mix of intensity and isolation, I guess.
I feel like the difference, though, is with Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, there seems to be a feeling like there's a lot of time spent waiting. Specifically, I'm going on an embed, but I can't until they go out. I'm going on an embed, but I can't until I'm cleared. We're waiting for the ice to melt in the passes. We're waiting for my fixer to make the hookup. But even so, like, as with so many things that the movie kind of half does, mm-hmm. I feel like we only see a very little part of Kim Baker's journalistic initiative. Mm-hmm. We get a very small sense of what she's doing on a daily basis besides partying. And that, for me, changes the feel of the partying that she does. It changes the feel of how the movie approaches downtime, because it's very unclear to me how much of any given downtime is her choice and how much isn't. Whereas the characters in MASH are strictly regulated by when wounded come in, which they can't control, and which often happens in long cycles that make them work long hours. They're living entirely on somebody else's clock. It kind of feels like Baker is living much more on her own clock.
Yeah, that's another point. I almost wish, again, that Whiskey Tango Foxtrot had hit a little bit harder. Being a journalist embed, you are on someone else's time, and they are scheduling things, and it's not something where she can kind of venture out and do something or have a story come to her in a really spontaneous way. You know, so in that sense, it is different than MASH, where just suddenly, you know, a series of mangled bodies are just going to show up, and they're going to have to deal with it.
One point that Whiskey Tango Foxtrot does hit very hard is the implication that Kim Baker and really all the journalists are addicted to being out in the field, and that is a form of addiction, the danger. There's a very pointed scene where a character played by white man, Christopher Abbott, playing a character named Fahim, who is Baker's translator, kind of points out to her that she is exhibiting signs of addiction in her desire to chase after stories. And in that context, the downtime in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is not an escape. It's something difficult. It's something to be reckoned with. It's something to be escaped from through other addictive behaviors. Whereas in MASH, it seems like it is much more a necessary release.
Can we just do a quick aside about Christopher Abbott? Because
What about Alfred Molina?
Alfred Molina. I'm conflicted because I like Christopher Abbott a lot. He's a great actor, and he's
and I think he's and, good,
he's
good in this.
He's actually very good
no
in this.
I had no problem with him in this movie.
It's just strange to have someone cast. I mean, there are no shortage of Middle Eastern actors, you know, and like given the concerns that are going, I don't know, maybe this is a whole other podcast, but I felt myself very torn because I thought he was very good.
Well, whenever playing, it comes up, you kind of have to ask the question again.
You know?
Okay, so here's the thing with Christopher Abbott. For me, he might have stood out a little more in a film that didn't have Alfred Molina.
Yeah.
Because I thought Molina was just stood out like a sore thumb.
Just doing a very over the top.
Who feels like he comes in from a different movie, much more Tina Fey, 30 Rock kind of version of this movie.
I would say that both of them should not have been cast. I actually spent the last graph of my review complaining about that, which is maybe a weird way to end a review. But I was irritated by that. I think the year 2016 that we could probably find some Middle Eastern actors to play those roles.
Abbott
is terrific in the movie, and I know there have been. I talked to another critic who was like, I did not realize until the credits that was who played him. He was very good. He gets into it's actually what emotion I felt from the film at all was in the relationship between that character and Tina Fey's character,
which also felt like another thing they didn't explore quite enough.
It's a really hard thing that Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is trying to pull off. It is the degree of difficulty of trying to comment on all of these things and try to mix and match different tones and try and different bits of political and feminist commentary. I mean, this is a film with a big agenda. It's not that far off. It just needs to be, an hour longer. I think maybe the direction just needs to have more of a point of view. I mean, that's the big difference to me between it and MASH, is that you really feel the hand of a filmmaker with a strong point of view, and that really is a unifying thing in a movie that's full of stuff. And this is full of stuff, and it just feels flat all around.
I don't think it feels flat. I think it has a lot of peaks and valleys. And that is something I would be really curious to hear from everybody in this room individually about, is we've talked about how this film is doing 50 things at once. Like, what's your most favorite and least favorite thing? Because I really like the way the film deals with journalism when she's actually doing journalism. And I really like the way it deals with her being a woman in this environment. But speaking to your topic, the thing in this film that I was least interested in is how she spends her downtime. The thing I was least interested in is the rom-com aspect and who she's sleeping with, whether she's doing drugs, and what the nonstop party looks like.
I kind of liked the romance. I just really like Martin Freeman, and I thought it was nice to see him playing kind of a cad-ish character. And like, they're
who comes on to her not unlike a character out of MASH.
Oh yeah, too, for sure.
Yeah. So I kind of liked the development of that character and their relationship. I thought it had a trajectory that I think you don't get in a lot of kind of side romances. And I also like that it didn't necessarily have a resolution, or the resolution it did have felt realistic to that situation and those characters. I just enjoyed the chemistry between those two. I would not have wanted that to be the whole movie, and I understand kind of bristling at it being injected into this movie that had a lot of other potentially more interesting things to say. And the romance was completely fabricated, according to Kim Barker. That was something that was purely for the movie. So,
along with the whole kidnapping sideline with him.
That was so obviously not something that happened in real life.
Yeah. I mean, that was like some Argo level like makeup attitude.
Oh, I know. Oh, God. That was...
I just like Martin Freeman, you guys.
Like
and
Freeman,
even though he is an Englishman who is cast as a Scotsman, which is just
seriously
so offensive.
Why isn't there more Scottish representation in film?
Why is Christopher Abbott playing a Canadian?
Where is Ian McGregor when you need him? But most favorite, least favorite.
I really liked Tina Fey in this movie. I liked that she got to stretch out a little bit, and I thought I was actually found her sort of that sort of compulsion addiction. The way she kind of found herself over there, or found different aspects of herself over there that she was not getting at home. I found that quite well played. That being said, the part where the movie lost me was it became more about her experience in the actual war. So I don't know, but anyway, she's good. I'd like to see Tina Fey stretch out a little bit more.
It's hard to say. I don't think there's
you like nothing.
No, I mean, I think this is actually just kind of an okay film. It's not bad. It's not really a bad film. I don't think it's a successful film, and it's really hard for me to kind of differentiate between different elements because they're all just kind of near misses for me. But I think the whole gang involved here, Tina Fey, Robert Carlock, and these directors are comedy people primarily, and the film almost kind of gets in its own way as far as that's concerned. I mean, when it does have some funny stuff, I did enjoy Billy Bob Thornton quite a bit. Tina Fey does have some good lines. There are a couple of bits here and there. Nothing's coming to mind, but I recall there being a couple of the sort of like offhand, oddball bits of like throwaway humor that you would catch on 30 Rock. I mean, that's much more in the wheelhouse of the people making this movie, but it doesn't come through very strongly.
Can we talk a little about downtime in MASH? I mean, we haven't really talked much about that. And I mean, that's so much of the movie, especially the Japan sequence, which just for me, I wish they had cut it.
I don't. I thought the sequence worked quite well. I kind of taking them out of that environment and putting them elsewhere. I think a little bit more conflict with how absurd the hierarchy of the army got, the further removed from the actual battleground as it was, which is something that kind of gets returned to in the football scene as well. So I don't know. It worked for me.
I think one of the reasons it doesn't work for me is because it seemed so unvaried from, like, you get the sense that the 477th is the way it is because Blake is either a weak leader or an indifferent leader, or he's actively complicit in the stuff they do. But then as soon as they leave, they start running into military police and like angry generals who don't like the way they throw their power around. And then they throw their power around some more and it's all right. It's like no matter where they go, they're still the same people and the world still bows to them. And I found that just the realm of fantasy, basically.
Well, let me just say one more thing about downtime in MASH. I mean, I think the movie is primarily in downtime, and I think it's full of just really fun little details. You know, the drinking, the martinis, the fact
suicide.
That, right.
The fake suicide.
Right. What is up with the fake suicide?
The pranks that, you know, Elliot Gould with his jar of olives. I like it has a nice casual quality to it. It unfolds in a typical Robert Altman way, which is all offhand. And like I was saying before, one of the qualities that it appeals to me and must have been, can be alienating is that overlapping dialogue, is the fact that he doesn't hammer on any one joke. Things are just kind of there for you to discover in a much more casual way. It's just a different tone. It's a tone that would be replicated, in other Altman films, which don't proceed in the same way. If you look at something like The Long Goodbye, which came a few years later, you know, that's a noir, but it's not like some sort of fast-paced or even that moody. It's really just about a vibe, you know, and I think in MASH is kind of about capturing that vibe.
I will say that I do appreciate the immersive quality, that aspect of MASH, and that, you know, it does feel that you are kind of being invited into this world to just kind of hang out and experience it, whereas Whiskey Tango Foxtrot feels like it's like pulling you by the hand through the various points that it wants to make, and that MASH feels a lot more confident in that respect. And I do think that is attributable to Altman and his very specific style.
Yeah, and also to his constant focus on delving into a scene and then taking a broad perspective, a broad approach where a lot of different people become important. Like, as you say, the fact that Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is so specifically tied to one point of view is part of its strength. I don't think it would have worked as like a messy ensemble kind of thing, but it also limits the way the story can be told and the amount of stories that can be told, you know, whereas MASH has a much more broad approach that gets into a lot of different characters.
But yeah, you know, one of the things, and this maybe leads into your topic, Genevieve, is that one of the big contrasts, obviously, between MASH and Whiskey Tango Foxtrot has to do with gender.
Yes.
So I believe that's your topic. Yes,
yes? I'm calling my topic Women at War. As we have pointed out many times, among the many differences separating these two movies is the gender of their point of view characters, and the tone of each film follows suit. There's a, well, at least in Tasha and Maya's opinion, there is kind of a bro-y frat party vibe to MASH that connects it to something like Animal House, while Whiskey Tango Foxtrot's focus on its main character's emotional and romantic life has garnered it comparisons to Eat, Pray, Love, of all things. I don't like that comparison, but women exist in MASH primarily as objects of desire or as literal cheerleaders, with the notable exception of Hollips Houlihan, who becomes an object of scorn and ridicule when she declines to accept either of those roles. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, on the other hand, spends a lot of energy engaging with its female lead's internal life, for better and worse, and it gives her a strong non-romantic relationships with characters of both genders. And yet, both films, in their own ways, get at the fact that while war may be hell for all, it's a particularly brutal circle of hell for women. Hotlips' histrionic freakout is played for laughs, but watching it from a modern perspective, it's hard not to cringe a little at her portrayal as a shrieking harpy for daring to question the status quo, not to mention the ways in which married female officers have to bat away sexual advances, both welcome and not. And while Kim Baker comes from a much more liberated place where women are more or less accepted as equals, she's attempting to do her work within a culture that doesn't recognize that liberation. There are times when she's able to use that to her advantage, such as when she goes literally undercover in Hajib or infiltrates a group of Afghan women. But there's also a strong sense, particularly in her interaction with Margot Robbie's character, that being a woman in the kabubel requires a certain amount of emotional armor, whether that comes from internal or external forces. So we've already talked a lot about gender in MASH, and you know, I don't want to get too deep into comparing the gender imbalance of two films with 45 years and several waves of feminism separating them, but I do wonder how this particular aspect of MASH played to you guys after seeing Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
I mean, I think one of the things that Whiskey Tango Foxtrot brings across, particularly through Margot Robbie's character, who expresses it pointedly several times, is that there are so few women in the kabubel that if you want sex, it's there for you. And you can take your pick of people, and you see Robbie doing it in a really brutal way when somebody she considers below her makes a move on her. That repeated thing about, you know, you're a 4 or 6 or whatever back in Manhattan, but like here you're 9.5 and I'm a 15. It's just, there's a feeling that neither of them are there for the sexual buffet, but there is a sexual buffet, like if they're bored during downtime. Whereas with MASH, it feels like the genders are flipped there. The doctors treat the nurses as a sexual buffet, and there's only two types of nurses in the camp. The ones who go along and find it fun and want sex in return, and those who reject it and are roundly and repeatedly punished for it. You don't really see men being punished in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot for not wanting sex. You do see them punished for wanting sex above their station, whereas where their station is defined by whether Margot Robbie finds them attractive in the moment.
She's good in this movie, too.
She's fun.
Yeah. She's a lot of fun. Well, I mean, one thing I appreciate is something you kind of touch on is the film does show her using that to her advantage, like the whole sequence where she finds out why the well is being destroyed, mm-hmm. which is something that the American military, the men especially in the American military, could never find out. And I think that's something else. I keep coming back to this, but something else I wanted to see more of in this movie. Like, it's like, let's give us some more of that.
We see a little more of it when later she goes undercover in Hajib, and it goes poorly for her.
But I didn't believe she'd make that mistake at that point in her career either.
But it's also implied that she's acting out of this addictive impulse a bigger, more dangerous story.
Yeah,
I guess. And out of a misunderstanding of the culture. I mean, when she presses in closer than she should be in that situation with a camera, and the last thing she says before she does it is, "You can't get in there, but I can." Like, she just misreads that situation.
Right. Yeah, but I didn't think at that point in her time in Afghanistan she would misread a situation that bad. Or not understand what the rules were. That I didn't buy that, because I thought, and that's where I thought it was kind of the opposite of the scene I mentioned earlier, where it was kind of her very skillfully navigating into places, using what advantages she has as being a woman in that situation. So,
but there's also the aspect that she has those advantages, but she only has them because she has a security detail and a interpreter and military presence of a bunch of Marines,
and her translator also kind of intervenes and maybe gives her a false impression of what is being said to her.
That's true.
I mean she is if he were to actually translate some of the remarks made to her when she's out in Kabul and not wearing a headdress, maybe then she would be better prepared for when she goes to a much more restrictive city, Kandahar, and gets herself into a lot of trouble.
I mean, if I remember correctly, the first thing we see is her out on the street after a bombing, and one of the locals grabs her ass, and she curses him out roundly and colorfully and idiomatically in his own language.
Oh, right. I forgot about that.
Like, there's a sense that she is used to this by now, and she's picked up a bunch of local idioms for the situation, which clearly takes him back. So there is a sense that, like, she's learned something about the culture, and she's learned how, like, there's nobody standing in to protect her or translate for her in that situation. Like, she lets it roll off her back, and she stands up for herself. And it says something very important about that character at that point.
Let me ask you all a question about Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, because when I saw the trailer for this, my worry about it was that it was going to be, Liz Lemon in Afghanistan, and it was just going to be, a stain on the very notion of women in journalism. And it isn't that. But the fact that it isn't that, does it leave a lot of comedy on the table? Does it play against the strengths of the people who are involved in making it? I think it kind of does.
I don't, because I think Tina Fey was instrumental in having this movie made. She was one of the producers. She acquired the rights to the book. She had Paramount acquire the rights to the book. She brought in Lorne Michaels. She brought in the writer, who's somebody she's worked with a bunch and co-created Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt with.
And
30 Rock. She was very much, like, I think that this is largely her vision. And I think part of her vision is she wanted to deal with some of these things about women in war. She wanted to deal with issues of feminism and representation and sexual identity and oppression in other countries, like all of these things. She's a very politically active and specific person. And I don't think that she's undercutting herself by not just playing to humor.
Speaking to Tina Fey's involvement, it was actually Michiko Kukutani's review of the Taliban Shuffle in the New York Times that suggested Tina Fey. She writes that she depicts herself as a sort of Tina Fey character. Mm-hmm. And I was actually listening to an interview with Barker where, she says after hearing that, she like called her agent and was like, make sure you send this to Tina Fey's people. And her agent was like, what do you think I am? Of course, I've already done it. But so I think that there is some of that suggested in the original text. It's not necessarily imposing Faye and Carlock's comedic viewpoint on something that doesn't already suggest it.
Yeah, and as I say, the excerpts of the book that I've read are more political and more informed than the movie feels. I think that the movie did dial back pretty sharply in the direction of accessibility and a certain amount of comedy. I think it's trying to kind of meet in the middle between Tina Fey's comic side, her political interest, and then the book itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about the movie. That's, again, just the fundamental problem with the movie is it's so neither here nor there on a lot of different elements like that, where this does feel so much, this is such a classic fish out of water premise, but it doesn't go all the way with it, and it doesn't go all the way with, you know, with the horror of war angle or journalism angle or the commitment to getting stories out of Afghanistan. That sharp political angle, that's not explored all the way. It's just right kind of in a bad spot right in the middle.
I guess I engage its sort of half-formed engagement with all of those things more than I enjoyed MASH's kind of laser focus on this one specific view of war. So, but
yeah,
you
me
know,
too.
Your mileage would be very.
To me, it just comes down to, like, I would rather see the ambition that they're trying to display here of trying to do too many things than them trying to do too few things or too predictable things. Fish out of water comedy would be a very predictable approach. Making it full rom-com would be a very predictable approach. I had the same problem that you had fully engaging with the film, but I really like the fact that it's trying to do all these things. I like its ambition. And it makes me respect it more.
Yeah, it's got to come strong. Come strong or don't come at all.
How about this? We can respect MASH's stylistic ambition and success if you can respect Whiskey Tango Foxtrot's narrative ambition that it may not necessarily have achieved.
Well, I'm going to say that our listeners can judge for themselves because MASH is widely available on DVD and Blu-ray. The most recent edition is an album commentary and some nice making of features that are informed this podcast. And it's on various on-demand services as well. Whiskey Tango Foxtrot is currently in theaters. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes it'll put something interesting on your radar. Genevieve, want to kick us off?
Well, I haven't actually seen a whole lot of movies lately. I've been kind of in TV land, which we don't talk about the devil TV on this podcast.
Wait, you watch TV too? Do we all watch TV?
Should we have a podcast about it?
I threw all my TVs away.
But I, as is my wont, I will bring a film-related item to the table, or a couple, and in the form of some podcasts. We like those. First, just a real quick recommendation for a recent episode of a podcast that I know Tasha and I both like, Nerdette, produced out of Chicago's WBEZ. There is a conversation with Kim Barker on Tina Fey playing her in Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. And, you know, we kind of fainted at talking about the adaptation aspect of that film without any of us having read the book. So if you are curious about knowing more of what was left in and what was taken out and what was changed, this is a really good resource for that. But my main recommendation is a podcast that I'm sure pretty much everyone who listens to this show is familiar with, but I just kind of want to remind everyone that You Must Remember This is back with a great new series on The Blacklist. You know, it's Karina Longworth's podcast kind of exploring the forgotten histories of cinema's first 100 years or however she says it.
That's a very good Karina Longworth.
Coming for you, Karina. No, but there... the show took a break last December and was kind of off the radar for a couple months. So, you know, if it fell out of your podcast queue, don't need to feel bad about that. But it came roaring back with this great new series on the Hollywood Blacklist. I think they've done 5 episodes so far covering kind of the prehistory of the Blacklist and then kind of getting into specific figures like Dorothy Parker and Humphrey Bogart and John Huston. And I have no idea how long it's going to be going. You know, this is a podcast that did a 20-part series on Charlie Manson in Hollywood, so it could go on for a full year. But I recommend you jump on the train now because it's great.
Yeah, that show gives me podcasting. She's so good. Yeah. Oh, just on both a research and a production level, oh, it's so good.
You got to back both those podcasts. But on the Nerdette tip, their interview a few podcasts back with Caitlin Moran is one of my all-time favorite episodes of any podcast. She's a humor writer, and they dig kind of deep into her writing and feminism and being a woman and kind of approaching the world with humor instead of frustration when you're frustrated. It's hilarious and beautiful. I love Nerdette.
Also, had a recent interview with Nick Hornby, who did Brooklyn, which we all liked, too. So there's another sort of film inroad to Nerdette for you.
I did not know he was nearly so accent-y until I listened to that podcast.
Scott, what about you? What do you got for us?
Well, I spent last weekend at the True False Film Festival in Columbia, Missouri, which I highly recommend to you, the listener, if you like great documentaries, parties, and more delicious comfort food than you can possibly eat. I tried, though. God, did I try. So I saw lots of great films there that are just kind of starting to roll out onto the festival circuit, and a lot of them haven't found distribution yet. But I wanted to put one film on your radar that will definitely be coming out later this year in art houses and on Showtime. It's called Wiener, and it's about Anthony Wiener, the former New York Democratic congressman who was run out of office after he accidentally posted photos of himself in his underwear on Twitter. Don't do that, people. It's a bad thing. Wiener is married to Huma Abedin, who is known as Hillary Clinton's sort of right-hand woman and was seen as half of a very powerful political marriage. And Wiener is about his attempt to mount a comeback by running for mayor of New York City, which goes great until until another round of sexts surface and he and his wife are newly humiliated. The film is very slick, you know, and it strikes me as sort of an attempt at image rehabilitation that got more interesting when Wiener's campaign went completely off the rails. But still, there's a lot of really interesting and important questions here about the private lives of public figures and whether someone like Wiener should be punished for reckless behavior that's outside his job. Maybe you have different opinions. The film certainly will engage you, and you definitely get a sense of his political talent, which is so much, which stands in incredibly sharp contrast to the, of course, the winner of the contest, who is Bill de Blasio, who has all kinds of problems as a politician. The film reminded me a lot of The War Room. So if you liked The War Room, I think this is a really nice sort of inside look at how the system works. It is a fascinating and kind of ugly thing to see. What about you, Keith Phipps?
I'll keep it brief since I've been talking the whole episode. But, you know, we had a choice of several current films to go with here, and with Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. I'm glad we did. It was a good conversation. MASH is certainly a very fruitful topic. But before this, Genevieve and Tasha saw the other film we were considering called Zootopia and said, yeah, it's pretty good. I'm not sure there's enough there. What are you talking about? It's great. Zootopia is it's delightful.
I thought it would be a good pairing with Song of the South, but that might have been hard to find.
it's really difficult to recommend a film that people can only see illegally.
Yeah, that's true. That would have been a good episode. Maybe we'll do that. The alternate universe in which we did that, it was also a very good episode. But no, I saw it with my kid, and she was enthralled by it and came out wanting to be Officer Hops. I think it's beautifully animated. It's a not subtle but well executed parable about race and prejudice woven into this really rich anthropomorphic world set in a city called Zootopia, where predators and prey have worked out their differences, except not really, because there's a lot of differences, you know, a lot of problems still underlying that. I liked it. I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
I definitely liked it.
And probably again and again and again. I have a 4-year-old.
I do think that central allegory is really interesting. I don't think it holds together through the entirety of the movie. I think it gets a little muddled.
I don't think it's neat. I just think it's, I think it's effective.
It is. I really respected that the film went there and did it in an interesting way and in a pretty lovely way. And I do really like the world.
I thought it was fine.
I thought it was very fine.
Tasha, what have you got?
Did you think it was near mint, Keith? Just out of curiosity. I don't know. Just we seem to be great in comics. No, I don't want to undersell Zootopia. I think it's a sweet film, and I think it's got a lot of interesting things going on. It just I wasn't over the moon for it. However, I think bringing a 4-year-old to it gives you such a different perspective on it. Next time around, I'll borrow a 4-year-old. Yeah.
Although it may have been the screaming baby behind us at the screening that
that baby was not enjoying Zootopia.
No.
Wow. Don't take baby. babies to things.
To anything.
Tasha, what about, well, is there something you are over the moon for?
There are a couple things I'm over the moon for. Both of these people who follow my Twitter will be way ahead of the game and can just tune out right now. But a couple of recent articles in culture magazines that are way off my normal reading list. There was an article in the Pacific Standard a couple weeks ago by Rachel Syme that was tracking down what she calls the six original feminists of Hollywood. And it's a deep historical dive and an oral history into what happened when six women got together in 1979 and sued a couple of the major studios for lack of female representation, for essentially gender discrimination. And Rachel tracked down, sadly not our Rachel, we miss you. We really missed you in this particular conversation so badly, Rachel.
She would have been so angry.
I know. Her
she would have been angry at you two.
Her imaginary anger is delicious. Rachel Syme tracked down five of the original Hollywood Six and talked to them in detail about what drove their attempts to have film careers, what kept them from having film careers, like the sexism of the industry in the 70s and 80s, what they did about it, what came from it. And all of this might sound, it's a very long article, and this might sound very heavy, but it's light, it's funny, the piece really moves, their personalities come across so clearly and well. And like, these are all people who were kind of pushed out of the careers that they wanted to have because those careers just did not exist for them in 1979. But it's a really interesting window into the time. And it also kind of comes from the perspective of, this is potentially lost history that we shouldn't lose. This is potentially six names that people have not heard in 20 years and that they should be really aware of. That article is called The Original Six, The Story of Hollywood's Forgotten Feminist Crusaders, and it is a really entertaining read.
That should be on your radar, too. They do that
Pacific Standard? Yeah, they did good. That toast story. Remember the artisanal toast story from a couple years back that was so amazing? It became like a This American Life episode.
Yeah, it should put on your Twitter feed or something. They put out some good stuff.
Oh, there's so much Twitter, though.
What else, though, Tasha?
The other thing is an article that turned up in Business Insider. Scott, I'm gonna call an audible and have you pronounce the writer's name for me.
Jason Garacio.
And what did Jason Garacio do for the Dissolve, Scott?
He wrote a really fantastic oral history of Hoop Dreams.
And for Business Insider, he wrote a really fascinating interview with Thomas Lennon about what the experience was like being in Terrence Malick's Knight of Cups. Which apparently Malick just called him in for. If anybody's seen the movie, they will recognize the giant Hollywood Hills party with all of these actual real life celebrities. It lasts about 5 minutes in the film, just sort of this like camera wandering through it all. Apparently it was an 11-hour shoot. Mm. And for this 11-hour shoot, Lennon was given a card that said on it, there's no such thing as a fireproof wall, and was told just kind of be inspired by it. There's so much detail about what it's like to shoot for Malick in this article. It's really entertaining and it's really wacky. And I didn't love that film. And reading this article made me love it even less, but made me love the article a lot more. Scott Devise is rocking back and forth in pain in his chair right now.
This is all inside the sausage factory. I shouldn't be impacting one's thoughts on one of the great filmmakers of our time.
Yeah, actually, I it's not as it's my least favorite Terrence Malick film, which is tough to say, but that makes sense to me. Actually, that really makes sense to me is how that is a note you hand an actor to produce the type of films that Terrence Malick makes. I don't see it as crazy or I think it's funny and you know it's neat to hear Lennon's perspective on it. But no, that seems like a very sensible approach to making a Terrence Malick movie.
I haven't seen the new film, so I can't. Maybe it's the one that turns me against him. I've heard from a lot of people that is the case, which is upsetting. But you know, when the guy's trying to reinvent cinema, going to be some stumbles here and there, yes.
I would say it didn't turn me against Malick. That's a strong statement. It confirmed a few concerns that I had about the movie, and it made them a lot more entertaining. So
no, it's a very entertaining piece. I don't want to take away from it.
So there you go.
Thanks, guys. I will track down those articles. And I was on board with what you must remember this early on, and for some reason I kind of fell behind. So now it's a good time to catch up. So thanks. And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out March 29th and 31st. Scott, tell us about our next pairing.
The new movie 10 Cloverfield Lane, a nominal sequel to the alien invasion movie Cloverfield, opens with a woman packing her bags and making a quick dash out of town, only to peel off the road in the middle of the night and wind up in a completely unexpected and dangerous situation. In that way, and many others, the film reminded us of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Next time on the Next Picture Show, we'll talk about Psycho and 10 Cloverfield Lane and the marketing, twists, and suspense set pieces that tie them together. Maybe we'll talk a little taxidermy, too.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of MASH, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Tasha?
You can find me at The Verge writing about film, TV, and general culture, and you can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. Scott?
You could find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. You can find me in various publications, including NPR, Variety, Village Voice, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, Vulture, and Oscilloscope's Musings. Genevieve, what about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky, and I will be writing about The Demon Television at Vulture, where I will be doing recaps of The Americans, which is a fabulous series on FX.
That, cinematic, one would say.
Yes, I would call it a cinematic series. So yes, the first one of those will have dropped by the time this episode comes out, so you can follow along with the season.
And you can find me on Twitter at KFIPS3000 and at Uproxx.com. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show via Twitter at NextPicturePod or by visiting NextPictureShow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks again to Genevieve for producing the show with assistance from Colin, the animal, Griffith. And thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. And finally, we'd like to thank our parent podcast, Film Spotting, for all their help, input, and support. Please tune in next time.
Suicide is painless. Suicide.